Hello everyone, you're listening to The Lit Pickers, a podcast on books and reading and fiction and non-fiction. And this is Dipanjana, and I'm going into vocal fry mode just at the thought of what we're going to discuss today. But this
she's lying. The person in front of me is actually Britney Spears.
I wish.
Yeah.
That vocal fry was from Supriya Nair.
Nice to meet you, everyone.
Has Britney Spears written a book?
Here's us being completely woolly-headed, because not only has Britney Spears written a book called The Woman in Me.
Oh.
It was famously read out on audiobook by Michelle Williams.
It was very famous?
It's coming back to me now. It became like a Twitter scandal.
Oh, this is just proving my old age and lack of,
It's proving that you don't spend time on Twitter anymore.
That is true.
That
or
is wisdom.
X, as the case may be. Though X has been, I think, very key to a lot of the stories that we are told today. And a lot of the stories that inform the way we have conceived of the nation. And it reminds me of something that I watched recently, a K-drama called The Arthdal Chronicles.
Fantastic show.
One of its final lines is one that has just tattooed itself into my imagination. The line is, "A country is made of a story." And the reason why I love that is that it really acknowledges how we are making the story that will create a country.
That's right. A nation state is a fiction.
Exactly.
Perhaps so is a civilization in a society, which I think is really the deeper truth that Arthdal gets at.
Yes. And the nation state, as we have idealized it, particularly in the 21st century and the 20th century, and with good reason, is the democratic nation state. A thing that is truly becoming a thing of fiction increasingly around the world.
Tell that to the 17-year-old communist blocking you on Twitter right now. X, my bad.
Yes. So today, we wanted to talk to you about a project called Democracy as articulated in fiction.
Because believe it or not, fiction writers do occasionally write about things that matter to us. You know, when you first brought up the question of democracy and other fictions, I didn't actually think of Indian novels. My mind went straight to 21st century fiction by writers like Muhammad Hanif and Shehan Karunatilaka, with whom we share so much.
So much history, so much culturally as well.
And whose literature really hits home because it feels like it resonates with parts of India's own, while being completely different in setting, in intent, in aim,
attitude,
and in scope.
Yeah. It's that sweet spot, you know, like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. The baby bear's porridge is not too hot, not too sweet. Like, it's just the perfect in-between thing. It's just right. And I think it's something similar that we feel when we're reading Pakistani or Sri Lankan, other South Asian fiction, basically. It's just the right distance for us to feel like it's not hitting too close to home, but it's close enough for us to resonate. It's close enough for us to relate. And in some of these cases, we do have very literally a shared connection. But it's a shared connection that has, by the time we're recording this in the year of the Lord 2024, it's been a while. And that connection has been pulled at in many directions by not just time, but also social forces and political forces and circumstances.
And yet things rewind closer than ever, which is why Democracy also feels like more of a fiction than ever, depending on which side of the bed you get out of.
We've done an episode last year where we looked at recent Indian novels that look at the politics that are sort of unfurling around us right now.
And fiction about near history, we called it.
Yes, exactly. So that is an episode that I would strongly recommend that, you know, all of you who are listening to us today also look up if you haven't already.
Yeah. Dry that hand on a dish towel and skip back before you skip forward.
Scroll. But I wanted to talk about stories that are not quite so obvious in their political intent, that are as literary as they are political.
And that you mean are responses to near history or to contemporary politics and life?
Mm. And the mood, you know. The imagination is informed by the emotion rather than the physicality or the data fact specificity.
And so there are a few more layers of constructed reality between what we read in the papers and what we read in these books.
Which also becomes somewhat freeing. And let me start off with an example. The Competent Authority, written by Shobhan Chaudhary.
Yes, one of our few entirely comic, rollicking novels.
One of our rare and great satirists. He was incredibly funny in real life, which doesn't always translate to funny literature, but in his case, it really did. Mm. And The Competent Authority was a satire set somewhere, I think, in the 2040s. It imagines a balkanized India where Bengal has become a protectorate of China. The central states have just become their own thing. And whatever is left, this sort of cannibalized remainder of India, the ultimate authority is the competent authority, who happens to be just this deranged bureaucrat. And the only person who can go up against him in a society that is just collapsing under the weight of its absurd cruelty is this 12-year-old boy called Pintu.
Isn't that your dark name?
It is not, but I would happily be called Pintu. Pintu is a very Bengali dark name, though, you know? Like, I can't think of somehow a Tamilian Pintu. So it's this little Pintu who has help from a corrupt police officer, a grumpy CBI officer, and the last surviving Al-Qaeda member called Ali. They come together and they take on the competent authority.
No spoilers, please.
Yeah, it is so funny and so dark.
And by virtue of being singular, because the front benchers who write Indian literary fiction produce very little comic fiction.
Yeah, yeah.
And among them, none quite of the rollicking, open-hearted quality of The Competent Authority. It became kind of a unique artifact.
Absolutely.
And of course, given that we lost Shravan Chaudhary himself in a very untimely way.
Yeah. It is all the more precious.
It really stands on its own.
It really does. It's also that the complete out-there-ness of the imagination makes it possible for him to be actually very, very insightful about the realities of our present that he was addressing. For instance, if he's talking about communalism, if he's talking about elitism, he is talking about it, but he's placing it in a completely absurd, surrealist kind of space.
Right.
So it creates a certain kind of distance, which is safer for the author, especially when times are repressive and oppressive, as they increasingly are in so much of the world.
Mm. Not here, of course.
Of course not. We're very free over here. That's just awesome. I'm making little heart signs. Mm. But it gives safety to the author while giving them the freedom to really imagine the best and the worst, which is what The Competent Authority does.
Right. Very hard to do at novel length, right?
Very hard to do at novel length, I think. And very hard to do at novel length while keeping it funny, which is what Competent Authority does.
Accomplishes.
It does not lose humor for a moment.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is not to say that I dislike the front benchers who can rarely put jokes in their novels. And even though this is very unfair for me to say because he is truly one of the greats, I'm following this up by taking the name of Rohinton Mistry, who does have a sense of humor.
He's very, very witty.
He's caustic.
Yes.
But who faces up to reality in a way that leaves you incapable of laughing. I think the two I have in mind are both A Fine Balance and Such a Long Journey. Mm. Of course, A Fine Balance is more openly about the times it was commenting on, emergency era India, where truly unspeakable things happen to these two woeful heroes. Oh. Mistry was perhaps most famously in the news in this decade for having Such a Long Journey taken off the reading lists at the University of Mumbai because the Shiv Sena objected to how it portrayed Maharashtrians, which at one level is exactly the brainless bananas ploy for attention that you think it is. Mm. I do think it's not entirely free of a certain truth, which is that there is contempt in how Mistry writes about some of his characters. Mm. And that some of that is perhaps inescapable because of his own unique circumstances as someone who grew up in a very tiny elite community and relocated out of India when he was very young.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, I think the fine-grained and unflinching way in which he writes makes it absolutely abhorrent that someone would turn away from.
I remember the first time I'd read A Fine Balance was because it was on a syllabus in college, it must have been. And I've just felt heartbroken, like with every line. Like I was just like, I don't know if I can continue with this book. It's just destroying me.
It is.
You know?
Yeah. And it destroys you to the very end. I have seen some Dalit critiques of it recently. Hmm. This is because two of the central characters are Dalit and, you know, the very worst fates in the book befall them. So it is impossible not to feel like there's a certain amount of objectification going on there. Having said which, I think given the kind of blanketed silence that we see in pop culture up to today about the very real hurts that the emergency at its most brutal inflicted on Dalits and Muslims, I think its place in the record has some value.
No, it is of great importance. And I think not to say that the critique is not valid. The critique is always something that we should engage with.
Yeah, and the critique makes sense at this point because you have to get to a place where there is a multiplicity of voices before you can have that push and pull. If you and I were recording this podcast in 1995, when we had podcasts, of course, just different ones, we wouldn't have been talking about this at all.
No, and again, like you're saying, the stories that were not being told, and they weren't being told at all, for books like Such a Long Journey and A Fine Balance to come out, they were so singular in their time, the history and the recent history that they were recording, because really both these books have the granularity of nonfiction, right? It's so much focused on documentation almost in terms of what has happened.
And this is psychological acuteness that does make it feel like, ah, this is an emotional truth.
Yeah. But that doesn't change what you're mentioning about the Dalit critiques, which is, I think, a problem that a lot of Indian literature had, which was a sense of flattening of a certain kind of Dalit identity.
Yeah, that's right.
And
which hopefully people who are tempted to do that are now a little scared to do.
Yes, it's one of the great discoveries, I think, for elite writers, that they need to be a bit more aware. You know, you can't just resort to cliches.
Right, that the subaltern can speak and the subaltern is not you.
And the subaltern can and must be allowed to feel more than pain and suffering.
Right.
You know, the space for resistance, the space for joy. We didn't understand that from an elite perspective. For us, it was only possible for the non-elite to suffer in order for them to have value in a story.
Right. To set some context for those of you who may, for some reason, be listening to us for the first time, Deepanjana and I belong to the recent past, let's just say, in terms of age and education. And so this transition that we're talking about really belongs to us being educated and brought up in a time before the internet, where we existed in a kind of bubble. And without trying to make it sound like we've burst some bubble and, you know, are now social revolutionaries, I think the coming of the internet and our own growth,
it was enormous.
And our friends and some of our enemies have widened it.
Absolutely. I mean, we've learned and continue to learn about perspective, you know, and nuance.
In a way that when these terms were taught to us in our literature classrooms, did not include this
really
sort of thing.
Did not. So yeah, I mean, Such a Long Journey and A Fine Balance, also because of the kind of reactions they got, you know, like I absolutely cannot imagine a novel that brings those kind of perspectives and those kind of protagonists, by which I don't mean Dalit protagonists, I mean downtrodden victims of state oppression, a novel that just sort of focuses only on them. I can't see it coming out now.
At least not by an Anglophone writer in English. One of the good things about the widening of translation and publication in translation means that we do get access to some regional language writing now, which even though is overwhelmingly self-selected to privilege elite voices, does occasionally have writers with non-elite perspectives burst through, like the brilliant Perumal Murugan or Manoranjan Vyapari, to name but two.
Yeah. I'm thinking of someone older when you're saying this, Maharshita Devi in Bengal, who in some ways was, of course, very much...
Right, the classic Brahmin communist, right?
Yeah, a very, very strong example. You know, we were talking just now about belonging to a certain time and growing up in bubbles in a sense. Maharshita Devi is an example of someone who could absolutely have remained in a bubble and worked extremely hard in an analog era to not be limited in that sense.
Is the Bengali word Bhadra Mahila?
Bhadra Mahila, yeah. She rejected every aspect of that Bhadra Mohila identity.
Girl.
The good girl, exactly. Mm. So like when you look at stories like the short story collection of hers, Breast Stories, I think is how it was translated. There's a fabulous Seagull edition with Gayatri Chakraborty Spivak's essays bookending them. When you look at stories like that, you know, it could again have easily slipped into this flattening of identities. She doesn't. She's also unflinching in the way she writes about violence, which was very rare, I think, in her time, and certainly for a woman author. They're very obvious political overtones, proudly anti-establishment. She's most well known, I think, for Hajar Chureshirma, which translates to Mother of 1084, 1084 being the name tag or whatever, the tag that identifies a corpse. The politics are, if anything, lacking any kind of gray area, kind of obvious. But I don't think I have read much of, particularly in Bengali literature, which I have very little exposure to, I might add. But, you know, there's the visceral quality of the violence that she writes, of the sadness that is sort of, you know, girding these women who she brings to the spotlight. It's incredible.
I think some of that I have to ascribe to just sheer grit.
Yeah.
This is a woman who was just ready to lay it all out. Sorry to sound like a sports commentator.
No.
But I really, when I think of Mashita Devi and her output and her unwillingness to flinch, mm-hmm. which in some ways is an echo, I think, of Arundhati Roy, though they are very different writers.
Very different, yeah.
I just think of that kind of, that almost superhuman amount of effort that goes into playing a game like a champion, right?
Yeah.
Which is
there's a muscularity.
Just, yeah. You just have to do it. Peak performance for you is not just doing your best and feeling great about it. It's about passing through the bounds of tolerance to be able to do more than you thought you would. Maybe that's not true of how authors like Mahashita Devi write, but I think they do invoke that feeling as a reader.
100%. And it's exactly the opposite of what I was saying about Shobhan's book. You are not allowed to feel distance. You know, as a reader, you're drawn literally into the body of the woman who is suffering.
That's right. You're thinking of Dopdi, aren't you?
Yeah.
Is that a short story in Breast Stories?
It is. It's unforgettable.
And possibly her second most famous story. After.
Possibly. But even Mother of 1084, the grief that she's feeling, there is no way you can be outside that headspace.
Yeah.
It's written to envelop you as a reader. It's truly immersive. You know, immersive is a word that gets tossed around like problematic. It's everything is immersive now.
Right.
You know? But this was genuinely immersive. It's writing that does not allow you to escape an emotional state, a violated body. You know, again, like Dopti, for instance, the violence and what it is taking out of her.
Right. To be clear, this is a story set in a police station where this Adivasi woman, Dopti, has been hauled in on suspicion of being a Nakshal.
Yeah, which was...
And it's about her being tortured.
Yeah, and the Nakshal movement was, of course, something that informed the Bengali imagination very, very richly because of how many people across demographics suffered because of it.
Right. The police state at its most naked
in
some ways.
I think we're on our way to give competition to that era. But anyway.
In this country, surely not.
I don't know what I was thinking about. You go now.
I was thinking of men in power, you know, in direct contrast to women who write political fiction and their own penchant for penning fiction, for authoring novels, for inking great literature. And you know the most famous example of this, right? It's a novel called The Insider.
Okay. I don't know this.
So it has a fascinating publishing history. An obscure man, you know, barely heard of by you and I in the 1990s, named P.V. Narasimha Rao. And let me stop here and say, for those of you who do not belong to the 1990s, that P.V. Narasimha Rao was India's prime minister for an unforgettable period in that decade.
And also very highly revered for how learned and cultured he was.
By some people.
By some.
PVNR was secretly a writer, and he wrote a novel that was barely disguised fiction about his own life.
But he wrote it in his name, or did he pull a J.K. Rowling?
There was originally a pen name, and I believe it was, and again, I don't have access to any of these original
editions.
Versions,
yeah.
But about half the manuscript, I believe, was published in Outlook magazine, or some parts of it were given to Outlook magazine and then published when Outlook first began publishing in 1995. Mm. But of course, this was considered scandalous. And, you know, PVNR's own growth as a human being and his own political career, I think, changed his perspective. And so with some twists and turns, you know, the manuscript was rejigged. Mm. And what you now have is a novel called The Insider. very much under his own name, which is still available for us to read.
And tell me what happens in it.
Well, what happens in it is more or less what happens to P.V. Narasimha Rao. Although there's a kind of reorientation. There's his stand-in character gives way to a second character who is also a stand-in character. Most people who now remember the novel remember it because it created an outrage because there were some like explicit scenes between the main character and a female legislator.
Oh my God. Oh, I can't.
Don't worry. It's not who you're thinking of.
There's no way in which this is going to improve in my head, but continue.
I'd love to know if the book was ever a bestseller, but I do think its greatest contribution to the record has been that of a kind of historical artifact. You know, we've had prime ministers who are men of letters. Nehru wrote history and memoir, and Atal Bihari Vajpayee wrote and published poetry. How can I miss
the exam warriors?
How can I miss exam warriors and the poetry published by the man who is Prime Minister of India as we record this?
Also, to be fair, Mamata Banerjee is a novelist and an artist, much like Salman Khan. But anyway, I digress. So, The Insider.
But this, but I think this stands out for uniquely being perhaps the only English novel published by a man who's been prime minister, or a woman who's been prime minister.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's also Nehru's set the bar so high in terms of being the literary head of state.
Yeah, of course, you know, we could talk about this for hours, which we won't. I do think that that era has passed,
completely,
right?
And, completely.
I do think that perhaps what he has to offer the world is better than, you know, Churchill or whatever. Other men of letters and who were also world statesmen around that time.
Yeah.
But, you know, Nehru himself, I mean, although he's a man of many contradictions, I think there's a letter somewhere to Indira Gandhi, maybe I'm misremembering this, where he says, oh, you know, like reading novels makes the mind slack.
Oh,
I'm just like, what are you talking about? You know, you'd clearly, like, if I sat down to talk to you about Charles Dickens, you'd clearly never stop. So, you know, there's a man I'm glad missed the era of Twitter or X, because he would just not have been able to let go of people being wrong on the internet.
And also, I do think a lot of that output, and voluminous output, truly, Nehru had, would have been expended on tweets and, you know, TikTok videos. Not that I would have minded Nehru TikTok videos, right?
I think he would have been a yoga influencer.
I can see it. That headstand on TikTok, yes.
It'd do numbers.
It would. Okay, okay.
Yeah, let's step down from the lofty pedestal of people who've held high office in government. Who else are you thinking of when you think of democracy and its fictions?
In terms of the fictions that are inspired by democracy, I think one of my favorites of recent times has to be a book by a common friend of ours, Layla, by Prayag Akbar.
So this is just nepotism, right? I mean, we love Prayag.
We do. But,
but annoyingly, I have to say, I kind of, I like the book
annoyingly, too. Annoyingly, he is also an extremely gifted writer who, even more annoyingly, has not written another book.
Both sickening things.
Yes. So here's the thing, right? Like, I actually came to Layla a bit late because I did know Prayag, right? And continue to know Prayag. Because I was like, oh, you know, what if I don't like it?
Right.
And then I did end up reading it. And it's a brilliant novel.
It's enormously accomplished. I have to say, I haven't seen the Netflix series.
You save yourself, don't.
It's adapted.
No, 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 really don't. I hope it did good things for all those involved.
And I hope it made Prayag enormously rich.
I really hope so. However, the book is so much richer, right? And so beautifully imagined.
And it's not quite near history, but it's near reality,
Reality.
Which is almost reality.
Yeah.
Can you summarize the book for our listeners who were born after its publication?
Which is also crazy, because there are actually reading members of the public born after Layla was published.
I mean, to be fair, they're reading Noddy, but
it's okay. They're still born. Because in my head, it happened just the other day. Do you know what I mean? Anyway, so Layla is set, like you were saying, in near history, but it's a futuristic India. This is a dystopian view of a society that is fixated on purity. To that end, interfaith marriages are no longer allowed. Those who have interfaith marriages are basically hiding out in the fringes of society.
So you're describing Eastern Uttar Pradesh.
No. And there are no specifics mentioned here. So our protagonist is a woman called Shalini. Shalini has lost her husband, who was Muslim, to these goons. They're called repeaters, and they go around cleansing society, by which we mean they kill people. When Shalini's daughter, her name is Layla, is abducted, Shalini kind of loses her mind. What follows in the novel is simplistically put, Shalini's search for Leela. What we get in the novel, though, is just an incredibly inventive portrait of a society that is collapsing under the weight of its grief and surviving on hatred, I think.
No, doesn't sound familiar at all. It's been a few years since I read the book, which did hit me hard. But when I think back, as you were speaking, the thing that I remember most, more than the characters, is his description of the wall that divides elite and comfortable society from outcast society. Mm. And as you might imagine, in the kind of world that Deepanjana has just described for you, the inequality is an abyss, but also there are just so many more people in the underclass outside the wall than there are within its walls.
Yeah, he took the idea of the gaps between society very literally and actualized them. So there is physically a gap and there's physically a wall that you cannot scale.
I can't remember if I was still living in Delhi when the book came out. I don't think I was, but I remember visiting, I think, while I was reading it and being stalled on top of the Defence Colony flyover in a taxi and looking out to either side of me and thinking, I understand the geography
Page
of this
64.
City. Here. That's right.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting how sometimes a literal wall is the best metaphor that you can find, right? Like Gautam Bhatia, everybody's favorite constitutional lawyer on Twitter, is also a gifted writer of speculative fiction. And his first novel was actually titled
The Wall,
because it is about an inside-outside society and a wall.
So what happens in The Wall?
Well, I'm yet to finish reading it because I started late for the same reason as you started Leela late.
Yeah, you don't want to read your friend's books.
That makes me sound like a horrible person.
No. It's very hard to read a friend's book, I personally feel. Because I'm not...
Yeah, I mean, all my friends are amazing, gifted writers. But it takes me a while to adjust to the reality of that. Because my first fear is always, am I going to love this book as much as I'm going to love...
The person.
This person.
And also, something that we tend to forget is that the book that a person creates is a very strange thing. It is, on one hand, absolutely not them, and yet very much a part of them. You know, like, it's a weird liminal space that a book lives in. Having written one, more than one, I can say, you are in many ways part of it, but you have also distanced yourself from it.
Yeah. And the infelicity is that you, as a close reader and also as the writer, can spot in a book sometimes.
Yeah.
Matter when you are reading a book in a way that, you know, your friend mispronouncing a word or farting when sitting next to you simply doesn't matter.
Just doesn't matter. Right? Exactly.
I like how we've strayed into talking about speculative fiction, by the way. And I think the change might have something to do with patterns in publishing themselves, right? Where politics, at least in Indian publishing and in Indian reading habits, is now much more easily channeled into nonfiction, because it feels like there's more quote-unquote demand for nonfiction.
Yeah.
You know, there's this new book that's out, City on Fire, by the writer Ziad Masroor Khan, which I've started reading and which I'm enjoying, which is about his boyhood in Aligarh. It's very likely that if he were writing in the 1990s, casting it in fiction would make sense to him, which is not to impose some kind of channel on his artistry, but simply because that might have been what the market wanted most then, as opposed to now. It is very directly about some of the fictions of our democracy. And I think those that touch on Ayodhya and what happened over 1992 and 1993 to the Indian body politic is a very rich subject for fiction. But I think maybe it's just now that a generation that grew up with that is beginning to cast it into fiction, right? Like Lindsay Pereira has written his new book, The Memoirs of Valmiki Rao. Umair Ahmed, who wrote a book called Jimmy the Terrorist, which came out, okay, to be fair, at least a decade ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's it. It's taken some time for artists of the pen to construct realities in a way that allow them to address.
Particularly when we're talking about stuff like Jimmy the Terrorist, for instance, which is a cracklingly fun novel despite its darkness. We're talking about novels that were still being written at a time when current affairs were still being reported quite freely. The response in fiction could take time to percolate. And there was research that you could do. There were things that you were seeing around you. There was nonfiction around you. We're in a very different space now where fiction is performing the role of the archivist in many ways. But yeah, like Jimmy the Terrorist, but there are others, right? I mean, I've always found that, you know, people who are writing like Omair Ahmed, Annie Zaidi.
Great little novel called Prelude to a Riot.
Yeah.
I know calling something little, particularly when it's written by a woman, feels belittling, but that's not what I meant.
It really isn't.
The economy of the novel is really something spectacular.
I guess like they're adding a layer to it, which nonfiction was not doing. It's not that the nonfiction is limited, by which I mean the reporting on a lot of these incidents that are being talked about in these novels. It's not that it's limited, but fiction adds a layer of understanding and a layer of richness, which I'm very grateful to when I'm reading stuff like this.
It's true. I think perhaps untangling the real and the unreal, or the factual real and the constructed real, is going to take us perhaps another cycle of the wheel to come to terms with, because I can only imagine that this appetite for real stories, and you've probably been seeing this in visual entertainment as well, right? Where for the business, the idea that inspired by a true story or based on a true story creates a certain kind of cachet.
Yeah.
I can only imagine that in some ways that is the market's deep emotional response, in as much as the market is capable of deep emotional responses, to the fact that we know very little about what is real and what is unreal in this day and time. And perhaps to read and accept the truths of fiction is going to take a certain kind of mental and emotional adjustment.
Because ultimately, I think what makes these novels and these stories so precious, molded as they are by the conventions of fiction, when we read them, we find ourselves, I think, settling into emotional states and situations that we can keep a distance from when we're reading them as nonfiction reportage. Fiction brings us closer to them, and in that, it makes us braver. It makes us a little more capable of handling the chaos that is reality.
In an age that encourages silence, it provides us with a certain kind of language that we perhaps did not possess before.
True.
And on that note, we leave you to go back to your favorite books about politics as we head off to dinner.
Because we all have to make our own stories.
And fill our own tummies. Thank you very much, Dipanjana.
Thank you very much, Supriya.
You, dear listener, were listening to The Lit Pickers, a podcast about books and reading made in the city of Bombay.
Bye.
The Lit Pickers is a Made in India production. Don't forget to rate and review and follow or subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, tell everyone you know about the show. Share it on social media, tell your friends and family, scream about it on your rooftop. It really helps get the word out. Oh, and use the hashtag LitPickers. Follow Supriya and Dipanjana on Twitter or Instagram. You can also find all of the books they've mentioned or recommended in an online resource via a link in our episode description. Thanks. Keep listening.